Every day, the graduate student writers of astrobytes.org publish summaries of recent developments in astronomy. Then we sit down with many astrobytes of our choosing and have a heated debate, something I bet you didn't expect. We call it Astro Soundbites. I'm Dr. Will Saunders. I defended my PhD about 3 months ago. I'm currently in an interstitium postdoc role before I start a full-time position with NASA Langley Research Center in about a month.
I'm Cormac Larkin. I am not doctor yet, but I am a proto-doctor at the University of Heidelberg and Max Planck Institute for Nuclear Physics. And when I'm not studying massive stars, I love being right all the time.
And I'm Kirsten Boley. I'm about to defend my PhD and win this debate. And at OSU, I work on planet formation and evolution.
You're listening to episode 90, The Great H-Naught Debate. Okay, story time. About 4 years ago, in the first year of this podcast, I had the idea for an episode to be a debate about the value of H-naught, the Hubble constant. And we're going to define that and talk all about it in just a minute. So, some background on me. I competed in mock trial for 8 years in high school and college, which actually was part of what spurred me to start this podcast, because I was looking for an outlet for public speaking and engagement. So I had the fun idea, let's make a trial episode, put Hubble's constant on trial, we could have witnesses, cross-examinations, a judge and jury. Milena and Alex really loved this idea, and as we started to plan it out, it just got too complicated. We wanted teams of cosmology experts and observers, and then we wanted a whole jury. The episode kind of grew into a monstrosity that we didn't want to touch. So it became a running joke. Every time we'd talk about what episode we're going to do next, it was, oh, we'll do the H-naught debate, and then we'd laugh, and then we wouldn't do it. So, 4 some odd years later, for my final episode as host, believe it or not, we are finally going to do the great H-naught debate. But it's not going to be all intense and complicated, because we don't want the episode to collapse in on itself to a black hole. We have no lawyers. Just 2 astronomers, neither of whom are cosmologists. So we're wading into dangerous territory here. That's why you, dear listeners, will have to serve as our jury. You will get to vote on the winner of the debate, and one lucky voter will receive an Astro Soundbites piece of swag. So you can vote either on X, Twitter, or via a Google form in the show notes, and we'll just ask for your email so we can contact the winner there. So today we are going to have a distinguished debate, an eloquent exchange, a cultured contest between 2 lovely luminaries.
Well, I have to stop you there. First of all, it's H0, not H0, and that's not the only debate I'm going to win today. But for those of you who, all of you are listening to this, not watching it, but I'm wearing a suit and a dicky bow because today is a solemn occasion, because today is the day we bury Kirsten.
Oh.
No. I feel like you were sadly mistaken, sir. The person that's going to be in the coffin has to be dressed nice as well for the viewing. And this is essentially the viewing.
Them fighting words.
Look who organized a viewing on a podcast. Ouch.
Before we get to all this high-level debating, let's start with some general introductions to get the listeners up to speed. What is the Hubble constant, which is denoted H with a lowercase 0 that is pronounced naught in the English language?
It is not here. No, let's take a step back, right? So about 100 years ago, maybe slightly more than 100 years ago, people thought that the Milky Way was pretty much the entire universe. And then observations came along of galaxies that were further away. And these galaxies seemed to be moving away from us, and it turned out the further away these galaxies were, the faster they seemed to be moving, and this got people very excited. So Edwin Hubble and Georges Lemaître independently researched this, and what's now known as Hubble or Hubble-Lemaitre law came out of it. And the idea is that the further away something appears to be, the faster it appears to be moving. So V is the velocity, and that's equated to the distance d by a proportionality constant H0 or H0, and that essentially tells us how fast the universe is accelerating. And the units are typically given as kilometers per second per megaparsec. So something that is, say, 1 megaparsec away appears to be moving about 70 kilometers per second. And there's values either side of that that we'll get into later. But the general idea mm-hmm. is that something 1 megaparsec away is moving at about 70 kilometers per second away from us.
This is a good point to pause and note that this quantity, 70, plus some kind of confusing units, is what we're going to be talking about throughout the whole episode. So when we quote numbers that are going to be a little bit on either side of 70, remember that that's the expansion rate of the universe.
Yeah. And so those units, you may be wondering, they're a little bit strange because we've got kilometers and we've also got megaparsecs. And it turns out that if you do the units, it actually comes out as a frequency. And if you invert this, it gives you what's known as the Hubble time, which is what the age of the universe would be if the expansion was linear. So that's just an interesting little tidbit. It's not the same as the age of the universe.
Okay, now that I think that leads into our next question. What is the Hubble parameter, which is denoted with the symbol H?
So the Hubble parameter is not constant, and this is very important. So H0 or H0 is the current value right now of the Hubble parameter. H is the proportionality constant between the velocity V that things appear to be moving away and the co-moving distance d. So H can vary over time, but this value will be the same throughout the universe for a given co-moving time. So that means that everything that we see as we observe it now, we should get the same H0 from different types of observations. And the fact that we don't is why we're sitting here today to bury Kirsten.
A quick follow-up to clarify. Is H like a function and H0 is like a specific value of the function?
Well, as someone who's not a cosmologist or someone who has never actually done a course in cosmology, I'm very reluctant to make definite statements about anything that I didn't search up before this debate. But H can vary, and H0 is the value we see now. So it's believed that H could have been different in the past, and it may be different in the future.
So I suspect that's a yes to my question, but we'll be careful. Next question, why do we care about the value of H0? Why not just calculate H?
So one of the reasons why we care about H0 is specifically because we want to know how the universe is currently expanding. Compared to the actual parameter H, this is something that we can currently measure, and it has implications for exactly the shape of the universe. And regardless of the measurements we've made on one side or the other of 70, this is particularly faster than we would have initially expected for the idea of a flat universe with our current model of physics, which kind of brings into this question, why are we accelerating so quickly? To sum it all up, we want to know why we're expanding so quickly and what that expansion rate is.
Last question, why would we expect different measurements of H0 to produce the same results? We know because the speed of light is finite, as we look farther away, we're looking back in time. So wouldn't you get a different value of H0 right off the bat?
H0 is the current expansion of the universe. So specifically, that means that everywhere in the universe at a particular time, we should have the exact same H0. So we would expect it to be the same everywhere for this particular time. So Generally, we shouldn't expect different measurements to lead to different answers, which is like the whole conundrum of the Hubble tension to begin with. And there are a few reasons why we might have these differing things in terms of finding different H0 values, but I'll just hold off on those and we can get into the debate later and it might be more clear.
So let me make sure that I understand that last bit. You're saying that though we look back in time to do the calculation because we're looking far away, we're still inferring the present expansion from those back in time. We're not looking at the back in time expansion rate.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, I'm still a little confused, but I understand why we need to have this debate. And I think you guys did a pretty great job with these intro questions. So let's explain the two sides of our debate. Because there are two primary measurement techniques of H-naught. The first we'll call theoretical cosmology, the lambda CDM, the cold dark matter universe cosmology. And that is our present day best estimate of the cosmology, the shape and structure of the universe. And it comes from the cosmic microwave background observations. The second measurement comes from the cosmic distance ladder, and specifically the part in the distance ladder where we measure type 1a supernovae. So, Kirsten, tell us which of these two positions you're taking in the debate, and just give us the quick overview on what that side is. No argument, just the explanation.
So I'm taking the better side. The lambda CDM value. So basically, this value is generally lower than 70 if we're using this as our benchmark. So most of the values measure around 67 or so for H-naught. And for this, what they generally do is you have measurements of the cosmic microwave background, so the CMB.
Remind us very quickly what the CMB is.
So the cosmic microwave background is basically this remnant from the Big Bang. Because the CMB is a relic of the early universe, it allows you to basically figure out what your expansion rate should be of the universe currently based on the temperature that we detect. And the CMB is very nice because it's roughly uniform across the entire universe. And the CMB is isotropic and uniform, and we can measure it to basically like a 10,000th of a degree. So it's very precise, these measurements of the CMB. And what we do is we take these temperatures and we put them into this lambda CDM model. And then that's how we infer H-naught. This is the gist of the lambda CDM argument.
Okay. Bit of jargon, so I just want to make sure we're on the same page. We're going to say lambda CDM a lot, and it's probably not important to understand every detail, but it's a complex cosmology, a lot of important numbers and equations and Einstein stuff.
Lambda CDM is basically the best model that we have for talking about the physics of the universe and cosmology and how we got here. So that's the lambda CDM model. It's the top tier physics of cosmology.
Okay, Cormac, you're up. Tell us the position you're taking in the debate without any argument.
Ladies and gentlemen, I will not condescend or bamboozle you with terms. I will not tell you to not worry about the details. I will just tell a story about a ladder, a very important ladder. The first step on this ladder is called parallax. It's the reason why you have to measure a chemistry beaker from eye level instead of looking down at it. We've all experienced it. Parallax is right there in front of us. And stars do it too. When the Earth goes around the Sun, the apparent positions of the stars wiggle, and the amount that they wiggle tells us how far away they are, because we know the distance from the Earth to the Sun. We can do this for some stars called Cepheids, so we know how far away they are directly.
Is this not your opening statement?
No.
This does sound like an opening statement.
I'm explaining the how we're getting to supernova.
Okay, go on.
We can do parallax for stars called Cepheids, and Cepheids have changes in their brightness, and this corresponds to a period. And by doing this, we know how bright these stars should be at a given distance. And so Cepheids that are really far away that we can't do parallax for, we know how far away those are too. And in some galaxies that have Cepheids, there's also supernovae type 1a. So we know how far away the supernovae are because of the Cepheids. We're going up the steps of the ladder. And these supernovae 1a all explode in very similar ways, so we get very similar light curves. We can tell, based on how bright we appear to see them, or how bright they appear to us, we can tell how far away those are. And so by doing this, we can get measurements of distance, and we can measure the Hubble constant from that. And this does not agree with the other side, but it's a direct measurement. And so I think we should go back to traditional values and stick to things that we know, things we can measure directly.
Fighting words.
Okay. There may have been some argument in that. We may ding you a point for... No, I think you're fine. Thank you. Now it's time for getting into the debate. Now, just because we have these two sides of the debate doesn't mean those are the only arguments for the value of H naught. And we'll come back to that at the end. They are the two main camps by far, but there are some alternative theories. There's also a really great plot that I found showing how over time these two camps have made measurements that have diverged as the uncertainties in each measurement have decreased. So while they used to overlap within their uncertainties, they've gotten farther apart in absolute value and the uncertainties have gotten smaller, indicating that the tension is stronger than it's ever been. Over 5 sigma tension between these two camps. So most people believe this is not by chance, that there is something going on, hence a debate. Here are the rules of the debate. Each side will have 3 minutes for an opening statement. After the opening statement, I will ask each person a question. That person will have 2 minutes to answer the question. Then the other person will get a minute to rebut. I reserve the right to give the first person a chance to follow up as well. Then you will have a chance to ask questions of each other with the same timing rules. At the end, we will open up for free discussion, see how the attacks fly, end the debate with a 1-sentence closing argument each, and then we'll discuss after the debate if maybe the solution to the H-naught tension is different than one side being right. And of course, listeners, you get to vote. Who won the debate? Which side do you think actually is correct? How will the community likely resolve the H-naught tension? And maybe where we went wrong, because again, big asterisk, we are not cosmologists. We're going to try our best, though. By the toss of a coin, Cormac goes first. Cormac, 3 minutes on the clock, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Will. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we sit here today at a precipice. Our universe is larger than ever before. Our telescopes peer ever further into our past, discovering yet more acts in the grand theatre of our cosmos. This stage has many ever-changing players, but one pillar of certainty stands resolutely as an immutable beacon amidst our celestial chaos. I am talking, of course, about supernovae type 1a. No matter where you are in the universe, no matter your initial mass function or your metallicity, stars will form. Many will leave behind a degenerate remnant, a lowly white dwarf. Most of these are destined to cool forever, but a lucky few will rise again like phoenixes. They would explode in a fiery thermonuclear runaway reaction. In a universe so diverse, it is a miracle that these explosions are very, very alike. Their consistent luminosity profiles, meticulously calibrated through rigorous empirical analyses over decades using Cepheid variables, afford astronomers a trustworthy yardstick with which to measure the vast expanses of intergalactic space. There is a good reason why we call them standard candles. We do not need to claim a comprehensive understanding of the dust in our Milky Way. We do not need to claim that our model explains everything. We require no model dependence. And yet there is the other side, with the arrogance to refer to themselves as precision cosmology. In the words of Lev Landau, cosmologists are often in error, but never in doubt. There is a sting in the tail of the CMB. It is not isotropic as we observe it. We see a dipole. This dipole is 100 times larger than the small-scale fluctuations responsible for today's large-scale intergalactic structures. They claim this dipole is fine. They say that we're moving with respect to what they call the cosmic rest frame, and this is due to the local Banner distribution not being completely homogeneous. This should converge to the CMB frame at some distance, but this has not been observed, even 3 times further away than predicted. Local bulk flow measurements show there is a 1 in 1,000 chance that we are typical Copernican observers, but the validity of a CMB rest frame is required for their models. If one nail in the coffin was not enough, let me present another. The isotropic distribution of quasars is a well-known fact. However, this is not compatible with our claimed motion with respect to the CMB rest frame to 4.9 sigma. Otherwise, the positions of quasars will be compressed into our direction of motion via aberration, and some faint quasars would be Doppler boosted into our flux limit. The rest frame of distant quasars and radio sources is clearly not the same as the CMB rest frame. This is a challenge to the fundamental assumption of an FLRW metric. Precision cosmology has become a game of measuring parameters. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I humbly propose that they re-examine the assumptions of their models instead. As we have seen, homogeneity and isotropy cannot be taken for granted. On the other hand, look at any plot of Hubble constant measurements over time. On our side, you will see shrinking error bars as we gain ever more statistics converging to a value of around 73 kilometers per second. We do not claim precision, but neither do we stand upon a castle of sand. Nay, all we require is the common sense and reason of you, the jury.
Wow. 3 minutes exactly. Well done. Quick clarification question. Please give us the current value and error bar of H0 from your measurement.
Well, as I said, there are several very, very consistent measurements from different observers, but I guess I'll pick the most recent from the SHOES collaboration.
That is the largest.
I have the plot here in astrobytes in front of me. 73.3.
With a uncertainty of?
Plus 0.9 minus 0.9.
Very nice. Okay. And one other. You mentioned FLRW. Can you define that for us, please?
It is the Friedman-Lemaître-Robertson-Walker metric, which is one of the rare things in physics that has four names. Usually they stick to two or three.
So it's an equation?
Well, it's a metric based on an exact solution for Einstein's field equations in GR.
Okay, so something really, really complicated. Let's leave the complexity of the solution to Einstein's field equations out of the episode as much as we can. Suffice it to say, we know what that generally entails. Kirsten, you're up. Opening statement when you're ready.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen of the court, today we find ourselves at a crossroad of cosmic inquiry grappling with the puzzle that is the Hubble tension. On one side stands the cosmic microwave background, a relic of the early universe that offers a direct glimpse into the primordial conditions of our cosmos. On the other side, we have the distance ladder method, an increasingly antiquated approach relying on type 1a supernova and Cepheids. Let's first turn our gaze to the CMB, a beacon of precision and reliability in the murky depths of cosmological measurements. Through meticulous analysis of CMB data, we find that researchers have endeavored to shed light on the Hubble tension, and despite our best efforts, it seems as though the distance ladder method still stubbornly persists and is increasingly distanced from the cosmic microwave background, the pinnacle of H0 measurements. Now let's turn and cast a critical eye upon the distance ladder method. It is an increasingly unreliable tool in the cosmic toolbox. This method is reliant on the observed relationship between type 1a supernova and Cepheids, and is fraught with uncertainties and assumptions. The very foundation of the distance ladder method rests upon the calibration of Cepheids, variable stars whose measurements are marred by discrepancies between ground-based and space-based observation. The inherent uncertainty, a mere 2% in magnitude, but profound in its implications, casts a shadow of doubt over the reliability of distance measurements derived from this method. Furthermore, tacking on peculiar velocities into the mix, we find that with peculiar velocities, the normalized measurements of H0 is found to be biased within the distance ladder method by more than 5%. Therefore, can we really trust the distance ladder method when it specifically relies on the precision of these measurements that rely on calibrations? As we weigh the evidence before us, it becomes abundantly clear that the distance ladder method pales in comparison to the precision and accuracy offered by the CMB, while the former struggles under the weight of uncertainty and inconsistency. The latter stands resolute as a beacon of scientific rigor and inquiry. In the pursuit of cosmic truth, let's not be swayed by the allure of tradition, but rather embrace the frontier of discovery offered by the cosmic microwave background. Thank you.
And thank you. A little over time, but I think the court will allow it. Question, you said ladder. I assume you meant ladder with two T's.
Oh, latter with two T's. Yes.
That's a Yes, that's funny. I mean, you could have made a pun there. The latter is correct, but the latter won't stand.
I claim bias on part of the moderator here.
Kirsten, please give us the latest value of H0 from the CMB and the uncertainty.
67.49 plus or minus 0.53.
Okay. So there you see it, the H0 tension laid bare. Two sides, both believe they're right. Both think they have science on their side. Both getting more and more precise and yet further and further apart when they shouldn't be. Now, time for some questions. Cormac, the distance ladder relies on all these different methods that are attached together. So if there is one incorrect calibration, which Kirsten did mention in her opening remarks, it could throw off the whole ladder. Wouldn't a direct measurement perform better than a series of indirect measurements? You have 2 minutes to respond.
Well, on the epistemological level, I would argue that any empirical science is predicated on believing previous steps in order to extend to new ones. We can only agree on a number three if we agree on what one and two are. So I think the principle of saying we have something and we build on that and build something else is completely sound. To come back to whether you want to make a direct measurement, I would argue the CMB is the furthest thing from a direct measurement because of the amount of assumptions you make when you do it. So the first thing, so Planck, which is the latest of these devil machines, it measures in the microwave and infrared bands, so it's really susceptible to dust. And so the first thing that these charlatans must claim is that they have a very, very good understanding of the dust in the Milky Way and foreground objects. They can mask that out, right? So first of all, you have to claim a model of that good enough, which is already difficult to do. Then going a bit further, we have to assume we know the physical conditions around the time of recombination when the CMB formed. And I wasn't around to see it, and they weren't either. So it's very model dependent. If your model is completely perfect and you know all the numbers to put in, then sure. But again, it's model dependent. Whereas these supernovae, these Cepheids, parallax, we see them. They're there. It's harder to make a mistake. The uncertainties are larger because they're measurements. We measure them. We get values, we get error bars, and sure, okay, as you get further and further up, the error bars might begin to stack and you get less precision. But I would argue that precision and accuracy are very, very different things. They call the other side precision cosmology, not accurate cosmology.
Ooh, very nice. Made a bunch of strong claims. Kirsten, you have a minute to respond.
In response to the cosmological argument in terms of models, the value is allowed to fluctuate. However, we generally use simple assumptions within our model, which has been done for most theoretical works in general. Basically, you assume the simplest model that you can based on your observation of the universe or whatever you're doing, which is a common thing done within science, and then you build complexity from there. Therefore, the simplest model is generally the best model. And also, there is no indication that the current Lambda CDM model is incorrect. There has been no evidence to show that.
I'm going to ask a follow-up question of Cormac and then give you a quick chance to respond. You say the science is built on trust, but why won't you trust the Planck collaboration? Don't you think they're doing the best work? Aren't they very smart people?
Well, I'll just give an example of model dependence. So one of the astrobites that I'll bring up later, it talks about the role of magnetic fields during recombination and the TLDR. If you include magnetic fields, you can get much closer to the direct measurements of supernovae 1A just from accounting for magnetic fields differently. And we have very little observations of this, so you're basically just picking a model that might work better or worse. It's an example of playing with the parameters to get closer to something that you get out eventually.
Okay, so now we move on to the next question. I am going to direct this question at Kirsten. The Lambda CDM model depends on many parameters. So changing any one of those parameters would change the value of H0 by a lot because H0 is a derived value, not an independent value.
Mm-hmm.
So as an example, there's a Wikipedia page that has a really great chart indicating all the independent parameters and then fixed parameters and calculated parameters, and Hubble's constant is calculated. The value of some of these independent parameters between 2015 and 2018 has changed by a larger amount than the reported 2015 error bars. So if that changes the value of Hubble's constant beyond the error bars, why should we trust the error bars?
So I think what's important here is to think about what these parameters are looking at and where we're getting them from. So most of these come from considering large-scale structure of the universe, as well as thinking about how the density of the universe changes or has changed as a function of time. As we get better measurements and do have better understanding of how dark matter works and this large-scale structure, we're able to improve upon these measurements. And while these measurements may change, you have to think about it in terms of a whole system of things. Generally, when you're putting things into a model or whatnot, there are different values that cause different changes within your cosmological model. So just because one value has changed does not mean that it necessarily impacts the other one significantly.
All right. Thank you for that answer. Now, Cormac, we'll throw it to you for a 1-minute rebuttal.
Sure. So I guess what we've heard is essentially whenever they come out with a new measurement with a new set of assumptions going into these model-dependent H0 measurements, this time we really mean it. I would agree with you, Will, that error bars should be error bars, i.e. the true value should be somewhere within there. And if you keep producing measurements where you're not consistent with previous error bars, you're really saying, this time we really mean it. Whereas if you look at the trend for supernova 1A-derived measurements, you know, they kind of start squeezing down. For those listening, I'm moving my hands closer together as the error bars are getting smaller over time. Essentially, we're converging. You can trust that there's something consistent about previous measurements, but we're getting more precise with more supernovae going off better statistics. Essentially, this field is becoming more precise as opposed to just, as we say in Cork, putting a hat on a hat on a hat.
Kirsten, you are given 30 seconds to respond.
I think that this is a bit misleading because if you're consistently measuring things wrong and comparing them to an incorrect or you're not accounting for your uncertainties, it doesn't matter if your uncertainty bars are shrinking if you're not accounting for all of the uncertainty that goes into that measurement. And for the distance ladder, generally we see that people are not accounting for the differences that we see in the ground-based observing versus the space-based observing, which, you know, tack on your 2% uncertainty there. And then you also tack on your uncertainty for not accounting for different peculiar velocities, as well as these measurements also depend on things such as gravitational lenses. In order to have correct measurements with gravitational lenses, you have to be extremely precise and sure that your mass distribution of these lenses are correct. And often these measurements rely on those.
Wow. What a debate already. I am just riveted by all the sparring words and high concept ideas. I think we need to take a short break from all this debating for our Quaturodeck Daily space sound.
What?
Now, I have been saving this word concept for some time for my last episode announcing the space sound. I was wondering what you would call it if you have something that occurs every 2 weeks, right? You might call it a bi-weekly or fortnightly, but what if you called it a 14-daily? That's actually what Quaturodeck Daily means, every 14 days, which is, you know, about how often we're supposed to have an episode. So this is our Quaturodeck Daily space sound. And yes, there is a Wikipedia page where I learned this. I can link to it. All right. Thank you. What do you think that was?
That sounds like either a nebula, like a zoomed in nebula where you're scanning across it, or galaxy perhaps, that you're scanning across it and you get the stars, and then you've got some dust, and yeah, that's my guess.
So I would say it sounds a bit like a really slow motion soundtrack of a piano being dropped on something, but since we're sticking to space sounds, don't ask me how I know that, I would say it's some composition of frequencies. I suppose all music is a composition of frequencies. I don't know, like if you did a Fourier transform of different things and stacked them, something like that.
Wow, you're both so, so far wrong. It's unbelievable.
Really? What is it?
Yes. This is a sonification of NASA's Earth science missions in the 54 years since the formation of Earth Day.
Oh.
Actually, well, this was made in 2020 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. So it was 50 years at the time. We're scrolling through time, starting from 1970 to the present day. And the strings represent atmospheric missions, so weather or measurements of atmospheric concentrations. The high woodwinds represent the geosphere, like land measurements, imaging, surface temperatures. The low woodwinds are the hydrosphere, ocean measurements. The high brass, like trumpets, are the cryosphere, ice caps, depth, and sea ice. The low brass, like a trombone or a tuba, is the biosphere, vegetation or measurements of forests. So NASA's launched an incredible number of Earth science-focused missions over the last 54 years and continuing to launch them. So they probably could even do an update in the last 4 years and add a few sounds to this. And of course, this was made by System Sounds, Matt Russo and Andrew Santagita. We have used so many of their wonderful sonifications over the years, so it felt appropriate to cap it off with something NASA, since that's where I'm headed, and also something System Sounds, because of all that we featured them in our podcast.
That was very nice, but I would argue by definition, everything you've talked about is literally the only things that are not space.
That is kind of true. However, they're in space looking down. So there's something there. Mm.
It's a good space. It's a good sound.
You can cut anything you don't want the public to hear, you know?
Oh, that's all right. We try to be transparent here on ASB. We let you really hear what we're talking about. And so now I'm going to blow my nose for 30 seconds.
Join our Patreon if you want more unfiltered ASB content.
So after that nice interlude, we get to go back to the heated debate. Now it's time for you both to ask questions of each other. Cormac, you will ask Kirsten the first question.
I'm going to ask a two-part question, but you know, to keep it clear for the audience, the first part of my question would be, so the alignment of quasars and distant radio sources is at 4.9 sigma tension with the velocity we'd need to be moving at in direction to be consistent with the dipole in the CMB. So either the distribution of quasars is something weird's happening there, or our movement through the CMB is not as required for the dipole. So what's your response to that?
Yes, that is currently an open area of research, and we are confident that it'll be tackled within the next few years for someone to win that Nobel Prize. So we've been holding off on addressing that.
Okay, and then the second part of my question. First of all, I'd like to thank my backroom team. So last week, I actually reached out to the Astrobytes collaboration on Slack, because we're in their Slack, and I asked them to send me all of their articles that were relevant to Supernovae 1A in this argument. So I'd like to give a big thank you to Wei Sears, Abby Lee, and Luna Zagorek, who responded to my request for evidential material. And I will now pull out my Exhibit C, MASH, Magnets Add Similarity to Hubble's. So the long and the short of it, magnetic fields can affect the modelling of the CMB, and if you twiddle that around, it gives you different values for H0, and this group studied the effect that would have. Turns out it pushes the lambda CDM value much, much closer to the direct measurements value from supernovae 1A. So as an example of model-dependent measurements, how do you feel that the value that you claim is so precise and the best we've ever had? And I think a term you used earlier was, you know, this new frontier, this pinnacle, and I quote directly, of modern cosmology. How do you feel that just magnetic fields, like one thing that as astronomers we really don't even understand, right? Even now when we can see them. Back 13 billion years ago, you twiddle plausibly with a model that's very, very plausible. You twiddle it around and it gets much closer to this other measure value. So what other, you know, there be dragons. What other dragons are waiting for us in this model-dependent sea of monsters?
Did you say pinnacle?
Yes, Kirsten said pinnacle. Pinnacle. She said pinnacle. I wrote it down.
That's hilarious.
Magnetic fields have been the bane of basically astronomy's existence to begin with. So I think that if we look to other measurements, I think just in general, as we think about magnetic fields within any field, the uncertainty there in terms of how magnetic fields work, it's notorious. If you get your magnetic field wrong, then something could happen. However, most of the studies don't consider magnetic fields just generally. Even when we're thinking about magnetic fields can also impact dust, which it can impact basically some of our distance measurements as well. And so I would like to point you instead to another method that also confirms and points towards the opposite direction from radio burst. So in terms of radio bursts, we found that actually this bolsters the CMB argument. They found a Hubble constant of 62.3 plus or minus 9. So this is consistent with the CMB measurements, and therefore we have been bolstered by this wonderful treasure. Therefore, because magnetic fields are so nebulous in general within astronomy, they're not a trustworthy method of considering this when we're talking about the Hubble tension, when we don't quite understand magnetic fields that well to begin with. Therefore, we cannot be certain.
Cormac, minute to rebut.
Well, I would say instead of trying to rely on all of these models where, as you say, magnetic fields are the bane of our existence, and yet twiddling it slightly can really change the results of what goes into these assumptions, right? You're putting a hat on a hat on a hat now, right? Why don't we go back to honest to goodness, traditional mom and pop apple pie and baseball measurements? Why don't we go back to our supernova 1A? We know they're there. We see them. They're bright.
What about the fast radio bursts, though? Kirsten makes a good point. That does support the CMB measurement.
Well, if it's based on the same assumptions of isotropy and us being as Copernican observers, not located in a bulk flow, you know, I haven't read that paper. I don't know all the details. But if they make the same assumptions about isotropy that I discussed already about the quasars, then that might also be an issue there. Right. Like all of these things depend on what you take as ground truths. And a lot of lambda CDM assumes things to be true and checks parameters as opposed to checking the assumptions first and then adding complexity.
Okay. And this was actually something I was going to bring up at the fast radio bursts. My counter argument would be that the uncertainty is pretty large compared to the other two measurements, but it does clearly land closer to the CMB side of things. Okay, now Kirsten, it's your turn to ask a question of Cormac.
Okay, Cormac. I would like to bring up this.
Wait a second. This is a podcast debate. How dare you bring up, just for the audience, Kirsten is now sharing her screen, and yet you can't see that.
Yeah, I the judge is going to rule that this is not allowed, Kirsten. You can bring it up, but you have to describe it with
words. I was going to describe it.
No visuals.
Okay, fine. One of the things that it plagues the distance ladder is that you have so many different ways of getting to this Hubble constant. And within that, when you start adding more and more measurements, you end up increasing the uncertainties. However, you claim that your uncertainties are significantly smaller. So first, the question is A, how can you be confident that you're not underestimating the errors? And B, I'm going to include this distance ladder into the show notes so all of our listeners can see. But basically, you have this convoluted diagram, five or six or seven different layers just to get to the Hubble constant to begin with. So how can you even be confident that, you know, one error isn't propagated the whole way through, especially if everyone is using the same standard way of calculating this thing? It could be completely riddled with errors.
I'd like to actually come in on that, because the reason why we have so many different things to measure with is that the universe has given us a wonderful diverse range of objects, and I think diversity should be celebrated. I would not... if the universe only had one kind of object, it would be incredibly boring. So I think the fact that we have RR-Lyapunov variables, planetary nebulae luminosity function, the tip of the red giant branch, I think we should be celebrating these things instead of trying to disparage them. Now, moving on to the science of it, there's different measurements used because different objects do different things. So you can only use Cepheids in galaxies that are star-forming, because Cepheids are quite massive relative to other stars, so they're going to have short lifetimes. You find them in star-forming galaxies, right? And so that's why, right? Because physics be complicated. But it's not actually that many steps. So I have the diagram that Kirsten's referencing in front of me, right? And the first four steps are Cepheids. They're just at different distances. And the reason why we need to do this is that some Cepheids are close enough we can use parallax, direct measurement. Having calibrated that, the Cepheids that are too far away to use parallax, we can use the Cepheid relation. And the step from the LMC to the local group is they're just a bit further away. They're the same objects, they're just a little bit further away. And then the next jump is going from Cepheids to supernova 1A. So really, we're just hopping from Cepheids that are a little bit further away to supernova 1A. It's not that big of a jump.
Okay, it's not that big of a jump. Kirsten, rebuttal?
But when your measurements consist of different methods of measuring, you're calibrating all of these things to each other, it's not as simple as saying that these are just a little bit further, just a different measurement, because they all rely on the calibrating to one another. And we've seen this, that you introduce significant amount of error into this, which can... when you start tacking on the errors that you include into this, you could end up increasing your uncertainty enough to where it would be consistent with the CMB.
Well, I would argue that given the larger error bars associated, especially historically, with this way of measuring, it suggests that they are more trustworthy. We don't claim precision. This is a less precise way of doing it. As you say, we are calibrating. We are taking things we know, and we say, okay, we can do parallax. We trust parallax. I mean, Gaia has been, by some measures, the most productive mission in history, right? So parallax is a very useful thing. We all agree on it. And we say, okay, some of these Cepheids, we know how far away they are from parallax. And then we say, okay, these other Cepheids are too far away for parallax, but they do the same things. They're just a bit fainter. And so, yeah, we assume that Cepheids a bit further away behave like Cepheids closer. But that's not as much of a step as saying we understand all the gas and dust in between us and the edge of the observable universe for the foreground models for Planck. I mean, that I think is a bit more of a step, right?
Kirsten, you have something you wanted to add?
Your response doesn't actually tackle the issue of the uncertainties themselves, because you say that you don't claim to be precise, but that's exactly what uncertainties do. They claim to be precise. Therefore, if you're not accounting for uncertainties, that could inflate your Hubble constant to something that would be consistent with the CMB, then not only are you not precise, you're not even accurate, because you're not accounting for the whole story.
Well, you brought up a diagram. I'll bring up a diagram. You have this classic kind of vertical diagram of the different Hubble constant measurements along with the method. There's various versions. There's one on Wikipedia. A few of the astrobites we've been talking about directly or indirectly have it. And you can pretty much draw a line between all the direct measurement ones. The error bars are a bit shifted. Some of them are a little bit off, but generally they're all in about the same place. Whereas, as Will pointed out earlier, you know, the direct measurements from different missions don't really match. You know, the different set of assumptions, different foreground model, another differently half-baked attempt at understanding the entirety of the universe's existence. Boing, boing, you know, that to me is so much more prone to potential misunderstandings. As I said, we don't know what the magnetic field was like at recombination, and yet that could make the CMB measurements consistent with supernova 1A, almost, on its own. And there's so many other things we don't know.
This is a classic debate argument. What's the stronger response, to rehabilitate your side or to attack the opposite side as worse? And politicians tend to go with the latter, but scientists want to hear both. And I think Kirsten's claim that your attack of her side is not a defense of your side is a valid one. And that could transition us quite nicely to the neither side is correct argument, and there needs to be a compromise or a third solution. And I want to get into that, but before we do, I think it's time for our closing arguments in the form of one-sentence summaries. Cormac, you get to go first.
Get back to old-fashioned traditional family values. Vote for Supernova 1A. One and A, it's in the name. They're the best.
And Kirsten?
Choose Lambda CDM. Because we don't rely on convoluted methods, and we know our uncertainties.
Ooh, simple and effective. A last jab. So that ends the debate. I enjoyed listening to this. I think we definitely scratched the surface. The question is, how deep did we get and how much did we omit? And maybe our listeners will jump in with some thoughts as to what we should have said. What were the top arguments? There's only so much time, and at risk of creating a monstrosity, we did the debate. I want to move on to the, is it possible both are wrong or both can be compromised piece. I found an astrobite. I also want to add that both of you used many astrobites in crafting these arguments, which we will link to, even if you didn't mention them explicitly. They were strongly a part of your argument. So that's really worth us acknowledging and also linking to, so listeners can learn as much as they want, because there is a huge trove of astrobites on the topic of H-naught and the Hubble tension. I found an astrobite entitled, "Is the Hubble tension actually a temperature tension?" And this argues that the H-naught value is actually caused by a discrepancy in the temperature of the CMB. Now, the claim is that the temperature of the CMB is known to a huge degree of precision, where 1 in 10,000th of a degree can be measured. But that is only a statistical uncertainty, not a systematic uncertainty. And small changes in the temperature of the CMB result in huge changes in H-naught. So that's one piece. The same bite also talks about how measurements of baryonic acoustic variations, those are measurements in baryons in the early universe, and how they can affect the present-day state of the universe, might support a compromise value. And there is some reasonable evidence that that's possible, though I think more recent measurements of the baryonic acoustic oscillations actually support the Planck measurement from the CMB.
That is correct.
So initially it was a compromise, but it moved toward the CMB value. There is an argument about gravitational waves, that because you have a way of measuring distance that does not rely on the distance ladder, we may be able to circumvent that or corroborate it. However, they individually have way too large of an error bar. At this point, you could support either with different gravitational waves. So there's another astrobite called multi-messenger constraints on the Hubble constant. And this offers that actually either value could be corroborated depending on which gravitational wave events you pick. There's a good graph in here. So maybe in time, but we'll probably need hundreds to constrain it. And then fast radio bursts, we mentioned them. Again, large uncertainties. So we're going to need time. It's possible there will either be a strongly corroborated result or that we're going to find a new value. So I guess the question I'll ask for you both is, what do you actually think is going to be the way that the tension resolves? And when do you think it's going to resolve?
So when I asked this question on the Astrobyte Slack, somebody actually said, I assume it's in relation to a recent paper and some results discussed at a conference, which I'm not sure are public yet, but there are claims that certain JWST observations may be making waves in this discussion very shortly. So it may even be out by the time this has been published. Obviously, I haven't seen that, but there's a lot of excitement around the Hubble tension. It's just actually coincidental that we decided to tackle this topic right now. but it could be a lot sooner than we think, potentially. I think one recent study using time delay cosmography from gravitational lensing, basically you have a lensed galaxy, supernova goes off from that, you get different snapshots in time. That's been seen for a single type 1A supernovae. There was an astrobite on it, which is titled A New Hope for the Hubble Constant, written by Skylar Grayson. So I'll quote the author's own words. This was only the second use of time delay cosmography to calculate H0 from supernova observations, and the first time using a type 1A supernova. And essentially, if they get more statistics, it'll become competitive with the other methods currently used. So this is another independent way of doing that. And I think that's very exciting.
That's a third example, adding to my gravitational wave and FRB examples, where we need a lot more data, but there's a chance that it could offer a new solution.
But much sooner, because the gravitational waves thing will probably require more kilonovae, because you need an EM component too. So although there's another LIGO run currently ongoing, that'll be fantastic, but we need a kilonova, because we need the electromagnetic component to get a proper redshift so we know how far away it is. And then the gravitational signal gives you the luminosity, so the magnitude of the light curve comparison to a supernova 1A. And so I think gravitational waves would also provide an answer, but we'd be waiting a much longer time. We need more kilonovae, whereas I suspect type 1A supernovae in these distant galaxies are much more common, but we also kind of have to get lucky to be observing them with JWST when they have a type 1A supernova. So this was pure coincidence when they detected this, and then they got follow-up observations. So I guess you're sort of playing that game of which transients are more likely versus which ones are you more likely to see. So I'm sure some very clever Bayesian people could figure that out. But my money would be on time delay cosmography for a sooner answer.
Fascinating. And very good point about the kilonova. That's true. It could be a lot longer based on that. Kirsten, any other thoughts on this?
What I found interesting when I was looking this up, having independent measurements, first of all, is necessary to break the Hubble tension, because you notice there's a ton of papers that are either for the distance ladder or they're looking at lambda CDM, but you're slowly starting to see a few papers that are, you know, looking, like you mentioned, at gravitational waves or fast radio burst in things like that. And I think that those will be necessary to break this tension. And particularly on like the lambda CDM side, there are a lot of people looking at baryon acoustic oscillations, like you mentioned before, which I think will be extremely useful, because the more data that you can get, the better, as well as looking at polarization. One of the astrobites that I reference in mine is the astrobite called H-naught tension south polarization edition with SPT3G. And this, they actually start to account for, you know, the polarization that you might get during recombination to actually point to better measurements. So basically taking a little bit more care into looking into different types of measurements and thinking about things that could potentially affect what you're looking at. But also, I think having these middle ground ones, I think since the gravitational waves landed in the middle, I think it's quite interesting. And although it's going to take significantly longer time, that's the one that I would be most interested to see in the future where that lands.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to need some new results. And right now, when it's two camps, it really feels like everything's going to have to fall into one camp or the other. But if we end up with four or five independent, reliable, and tightly constrained results, it's possible this really tells us something fundamental about physics, and we can all get behind that cosmology needs to be adjusted to account for this. But that's going to be a little while, so we might have to live with some tension for longer than we'd like.
Well, actually, coming on to that, so a large part of the arguments that I took about the, for example, the quasars and their distributions, it's based on a colloquium given by Subir Sarkar, Professor Emeritus at the University of Oxford, who gave a colloquium here about a year and a half ago focused on this topic. And he's got a very interesting article where he sort of lays out the issues with the current assumptions in cosmology, which we can link in the show notes. But I'll just quote from the conclusion that it is not new, this realization that the universe we inhabit does not look like the ideal FLRW model. Vera Rubin was interviewed for an oral history project and was asked about basically, what do you think, given this universe is more inhomogeneous than might have been present in simple models, has it altered your views? And she said, and I quote, "It certainly has convinced me that we're not living in a homogeneous, isotropic universe. I'm not sure the Robertson-Walker universe exists. If someone came with a different model that could incorporate such large-scale inhomogeneities, I'd be delighted to see it, but until then, I will just live with the Big Bang model. So there's probably no convincing answer that covers everything we see yet, but it's entirely possible that the universe is more complicated than we thought.
Which is really exciting, and we could be living through soon the biggest revision to cosmology since the discovery of the accelerating expansion in dark energy a couple decades ago. So on that exciting, possibly hopeful, and futuristic note, we will conclude episode 90 of Astro Soundbites, the great H-naught debate. We did it. We finally did the H-naught debate. For me, this has been like 4+ years in the making, and I am sure it did not live up to my expectations in my head, but we did it. We had the debate. So listeners, it's your turn. Be the jury. Vote on who won the debate, maybe what you think the resolution of the Hubble tension will be, and then correct us. Where did we go wrong? What did we omit? And how might we do better if we bring this topic up next time? Because we have been reluctant to touch this topic for a long time. And then we're going to take all the listener voted results, combine it with our thoughts, forward it along to cosmologists, and then they can finally set a value of H-naught and be done with it already. I mean, they've been debating it for so long. I think it's time to just pick a value.
Yeah, I think so.
They did this for the AU, right? That, you know, the astronomical unit, one of the standard distance measures in astronomy, is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. But that changes. So they just said, okay, it's this value. And 1AU was now just a dictionary value because they decided it, the IAU. Not because of a measurement, but because people voted on it and they live with it.
So maybe we can do the same. We can just decide what we want the universe to be, and then it will just be that.
As a supervisor of mine once said, all data ever did was ruin a perfectly good model.
Listeners, if you want to read the many Astrobytes that were backing this episode, and it was many, we are going to have a huge set of links in the show notes, and that's just some of the many, many H-naught Astrobytes that exist. That topic is covered regularly. If you loved episode 90 so much and have an approximately 75-hour car ride coming up, you can binge all of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, Audible, or Amazon Music. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to keep your ears to the cosmos.